غفلة تمتطي فوسا.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is produced by Despina Moutsaris. This is your host, John Roberts. Surprise, surprise! Netanyahu's Likud party won 30 seats in the Knesset in the election this past week, and he is headed to a fourth term as Israel's prime minister. That is okay, because no change was coming despite whoever was elected. And with Netanyahu, we know what we are getting without any illusions about possible positive change. As Ali Abu Nima said following the election, Netanyahu's re-election is like the nutrition facts label on a box of junk food. It tells you about the toxic ingredients inside. And while the U.S. Congress and the American right are rejoicing, Europe and most of the rest of the international community are sure to double down on promoting BDS and continuing to isolate Israel for what it is, a segregated, unjust, apartheid state. And Netanyahu, in order to win at the last moment, threw out red meat to his right-wing base by stating what we all knew anyway. He is opposed to a two-state solution. From the beginning of his administration, he has done everything in his power to make sure that there is no possibility for a two-state solution through his land expropriation, settlement development, construction of the apartheid wall, the pass roads, and myriad of checkpoints. The Zionist vision has always been to take the land. And that is exactly what Israel has done while babbling about a two-state solution. Finally, Netanyahu gets honest, and hopefully the international community will double its efforts to hold him accountable. This morning we continue our presentation of the conversation between Max Blumenthal, journalist and author, and Ali Abu Nima, journalist, author, and co-founder of the Electronic Intifada. Last Sunday, we presented the first half of their conversation at the Roxy Theater in San Francisco, and pick up on it as they discuss Israel's penchant for greenwashing. The conversation is based on Ali Abu Nima's latest book, The Battle for Justice in Palestine.
This speaks to, you know, a section in your book where you talk about greenwashing, blackwashing, and brownwashing. And pinkwashing. I think I've heard you say, you know, greenwash, blackwash, brownwash, pinkwash, hogwash. The Marker, which is an Israeli economics publication, it reports on the Israeli economy, has found that Israel invests over $100 million a year in a washing machine to basically. So this doesn't necessarily relate to the smears, but the image that Israel projects to the outside world in this post-Oslo era of what they describe as delegitimization. So talk about the washing machine and why you thought it was important to include that in your book.
Yeah. Anyone from the Israeli consulate here tonight? Well, they're in the book. The Israeli consulate in San Francisco makes a couple of cameos.
Is it Akiva Tor?
Yeah.
Akiva, if you're here.
Yeah. But this is important because the strategy laid out by groups like the David Project and another even more influential think tank called the Re'ut Institute. I mean, it sounds arcane, but so much of the stuff that you end up seeing and hearing on the radio and the newspaper has been planned out at these think tanks. And a really important one is the Re'ut Institute, which published a strategy in 2010, which was adopted by the Israeli government as their official strategy. It was adopted by the major pro-Israel organizations in this country. And they said, basically, the major threat to Israel today is not military. It is from a growing global Palestine solidarity movement. And the risk that Israel faces is that within a few years, it will be isolated the way apartheid South Africa was in the 1980s. So we have to fight back. So they said we have to fight back. And they identified the left. They identified liberal, progressive, and left-wing communities as their targets. And Israeli military intelligence, this is something that has been openly admitted in the Israeli press, said we're going to monitor left-wing and progressive groups around the world and monitor them for what they call anti-Israel activity. But at the same time, there's kind of a carrot and stick strategy. We already talked about the stick, the intimidation, the lawsuits, this kind of thing. The carrot was to try to win over these progressive communities by marketing Israel, by using branding techniques to market Israel as this attractive product, particularly to young people and those perceived as progressive. So there's been a really aggressive campaign of what we call pinkwashing, which is trying to sell Israel as, a haven for LGBTQ rights. Much of this is totally bogus. I mean, when you actually look at Israel's record, it's really bogus. But the idea is to align Israel in the minds of people in the United States in particular with progressive causes and thereby to win their support. And it involves, of course, it's not just saying nice things about Israel, it's bad-mouthing everyone else. It's making a lot of false claims about Palestinians. So frequently you'll see claims that gay men are routinely hanged and executed by Palestinians, which is totally false.
Caroline Glick just claimed that gays are hanged in the center of Ramallah.
Yeah, this is just absolutely untrue. There's no recorded case of this. So that's the pinkwashing strategy, and that's where the Israeli consulate has gotten directly involved, as I mentioned, with the Gay and Lesbian Film Festival in San Francisco. But it's happened around the country. And it's this use by Israel of cultural products as a government strategy that really gives rise and legitimizes the Palestinian call for cultural boycott, which says that, when a government is intervening in stuff to prettify essentially apartheid, I mean, you'll hear this thing like, there's no gay pride parade in Gaza. As if that justifies keeping 1.7 million people caged in and on the edge of hunger just because they're not Jewish. But that's what you're supposed to think. And with greenwashing, it's a similar strategy. Yesterday was Earth Day, and SodaStream, the Israeli company, is that the sound of a carbonation? I think you need to replace your CO2 capsules. SodaStream, an Israeli company that has a factory in an illegal settlement where there's no environmental regulation, where Palestinian workers are exploited, where the very land the factory sits on has been stolen from Palestinians, is marketing itself as a green company. And the Earth Day Network, endorsed it and partnered with it until Palestine solidarity activists made some noise, and Earth Day dumped SodaStream. But that's how greenwashing works. So it's the idea that we're going to bully, intimidate, and smear people on the left, and at the same time we're going to sell Israel to them as a product. And part of the pinkwashing that has really been incredibly, I'm at a loss for the word, but maybe it'll come to me, but it is this deliberate marketing of Israel as a destination for sex tourism, and particularly for white male sex tourism, which is...
I wrote about that in Goliath, about Michael Lucas, who is the wealthiest... I think he may be the wealthiest porn producer in the world. He's certainly the wealthiest gay-oriented porn producer, and his top production was The Men of Israel, which is, you know, features male Israeli porn stars, and they shoot a scene in a village which your family is from, Lifta, which is one of the few really intact villages that were ethnically cleansed in 1947 and 1948, and Lucas and his film crew shot a scene in what they called an ancient home. It was actually, you know, an ethnically cleansed home. I'm not an academic. I bet Judith Butler could do this a lot better than I could. But it was sort of, I mean, this scene encapsulated the whole sick logic of pinkwashing in erasing Palestinian bodies and replacing them with this social Darwinistic image of a kind of more civilized culture, and doing so in a really obscene way that was sort of insulting to the point that it denied that Palestinians had ever been there before. When Lucas appeared before the film crew, Channel One, the Israeli state TV, he was hailed as a kind of hero, bringing business to Israel and bringing positive PR. And Lucas has endorsed burnings of the Quran. He said that he hates Muslims. He is virulently anti-Palestinian, and he's not only heavily promoted by the pro-Israel lobby, but he leads gay tourism to Tel Aviv. So this is sort of, and he has helped shut down Palestine Solidarity events in New York at the LGBT Center, threatening them with pulling a lot of the money that he donates.
In fact, the LGBT Center in New York, because of pressure from Lucas, I mean, they caved in. It was shameful. They actually banned any events related to Palestine for almost 2 years. So there were groups like Queers Against Israeli Apartheid that had been meeting in the LGBT Center in New York who were banned. When Sarah Schulman wanted to do a reading from her book about Palestine, that was banned. And it was after, you know, her book reading was banned that, and people had been protesting continuously for 2 years. Finally, they won a victory and the ban was overturned. But, I mean, it just goes to show that on this issue, even in spaces that are supposed to be safe, that are supposed to be open, that is supposed to bring those who have been marginalized and demonized into the center, Palestine gets excluded by this kind of bullying and thuggery.
And I mean, there's an underlying assertion that those who are not culturally advanced enough, who are not as liberal as Israel, deserve to be occupied and warehoused as human surplus permanently. It's a very dangerous logic. That the campaign of pinkwashing is introducing, and that's widely accepted in liberal circles. You constantly hear this argument: well, Israel, you know, how would, you know, Hamas treat you? You know, this kind of argument I hear constantly. We see this argument appear in liberal publications and also in the New York Times. The New York Times is one of the key publications celebrating this false image of the good Israel. Now, you were, and I took their last correspondent, their last chief correspondent in Jerusalem, Ethan Bronner, to the woodshed. We didn't do it with insults or, you know, the kind of fabrications that camera...
No, we were just technically factually accurate.
And what you reported about him was that his son was in the Israeli army while he was reporting, and his job was to report on Israel-Palestine. So you can imagine, you know, if there was a Palestinian correspondent with a son in a Palestinian resistance faction, what would have happened. But, you know, another question is, what if his son had been taken captive, as Gilad Shalit was? What would he have done? How could he have reported objectively? And, of course, the New York Times public editor basically dismissed your finding.
No, that's not what happened. Okay. Let me refresh your memory.
Clarify.
We reported accurately that Ethan Bronner's son was a soldier in the Israeli army. And the public editor, who is the advocate for readers and, you know, the in-house critic, said that this was such a major conflict of interest that Ethan Bronner should be reassigned. They didn't say he should be fired. They said he should get a plum job as a New York Times bureau chief somewhere else. And it was Bill Keller at the time, I believe, who overruled that and just said, we don't care. And Ethan Bronner stayed there. And you reported about Ethan Bronner's business, essentially, with, a major...
There was a pro-Israel PR firm based in Maale Adumim, which is an Israeli settlement, running Ethan Bronner's speakers bureau. So he had a business arrangement with a settler PR firm while he was covering Israel-Palestine for the New York Times. And so I confused it with the public editor statement basically dismissing what I reported. It's very hard to get fired from the New York Times. Just ask Judith Miller. So we come back to the New York Times Jerusalem Bureau and the post-Bronner era.
Before we move to the post-Bronner era, you know about my meeting with Ethan Bronner.
Well, why don't you indulge us?
I like telling this story. But actually, a few weeks ago, I was in New York and I was invited to the New York Times, to the New York Times staff, off the record, call it the Death Star. The New York Times headquarters is. So I was invited to the Death Star in Times Square to do a video interview for a film someone there was making. And when we were walking through the, endless newsroom, I saw, several miles distance, Ethan Bronner, and I thought, well, this will be fun, I'll go and introduce myself. So I went up to him and I said, hello, Ethan Bronner, I'm Ali Abunamed, kind of did that. And he was talking to somebody else. I said, I don't mean to interrupt. He said, well, how do you know who I am? I said, well, I've seen your picture and I've seen you speaking in videos. I know what you look like. And then he turned to the person he was speaking to and he pointed to me, he said, this guy spends all his time criticizing me. And I said, well, that's not true. I actually also spend a lot of time criticizing other people as well. And he said, well, I can't think of a time you've ever said anything nice about me. I said, well, can you think of a time I've ever said anything inaccurate about you? And one other point about the New York Times, about Bronner and his successors and his predecessors, is that the house that the New York Times owns in Jerusalem, that is the residence for its bureau chief, is actually a property stolen from the Karmi family, a Palestinian family, a well-known family. The father who bought the house was a very well-known Palestinian broadcaster and intellectual. His daughter, Dr. Rada Karmi, is the author of several books. And their house, their property in West Jerusalem, is now occupied by the New York Times. So when Ethan Bronner's son would come home from his, military service, he would come home to a house pillaged and looted from Palestinians. And the New York Times just will not address that.
I see I'm getting some time presented to me. I was so much more we have to cover. I wanted to talk about, you know, the post-Bronner era just quickly and then move to more forward-looking issues in your book in the next 15 minutes. But really quickly, I mean, the Proverb Plan was introduced in the Knesset in Israel, and this was shocking to me. This is a plan calling for the expulsion of 40,000 to 70,000 Bedouins living in unrecognized villages, villages which couldn't receive public services because their residents were not Jewish, villages which contained Israeli citizens, Bedouins who had even served in the Israeli army. And the plan was put on the table in the open, and the New York Times, I mean, one of the largest plans for ethnic cleansing since 1948, and the New York Times did not report on it until there were massive protests and a massive pressure campaign, and when Jody Rudoran, the new correspondent, reported on it, she called it a resettlement plan. Like, they're going to be put in some, you know, nice condos, and, you know, they're actually going to be put in what are amount to Indian reservations. Some of the five towns which were built, according to the Ora movement, a subsidiary of the Jewish National Fund to, quote-unquote, concentrate the Bedouin population. This language of rikuz in Hebrew is concentration, and it's the same language found on the website in Hebrew of the Yad Vashem Memorial Foundation to refer to the conditions that Jews were held in World War II Europe. So what's going on? I mean, we talked about propaganda that's, you know, deliberate, and this astroturfed movement and this pro-Israel echo chamber, but here at the New York Times, it seems like they're not being paid to propagandize. There's something more organic going on. Jody Rudoran, who is an education correspondent and, you know, comes over and starts covering Israel-Palestine, having never been there before, and you have since taken her to the woodshed. Talk about what's happening right now really briefly before we move on, and what most recently happened.
Well, the most recent thing is that a couple of weeks ago it emerged that Israel had arrested a Palestinian journalist who was also a citizen of Israel after he'd come back from a journalism conference in Lebanon. He'd traveled there openly. He'd posted on his Facebook page about how happy he was to be at the conference. They arrested him. They put him in incommunicado detention with no access to a lawyer or his family, and under interrogation by the Shin Bet, which is the secret police. And it later emerged that they were under suspicion of unlawful travel to an Arab country and a meeting with a foreign agent. All stuff that later fell away and they dismissed. But during his detention, an Israeli judge had ordered a total gag order. The Israeli media were not allowed to discuss this. We at the Electronic Intifada obtained and published the secret court transcript. And for 5 days, while he was in incommunicado detention, the New York Times was silent. We went to the public editor, Margaret Sullivan, and we said, we would like to know if the New York Times, and after the gag order was lifted, they published an item about it. We want to know, we couldn't tell, what, were they ignoring this story just because they habitually ignore stories that are important to Palestinians, or were they obeying the gag order? And the public editor revealed that Jody Rudoran was obeying the gag order, and she said, Rudoran, that, oh, when you go to a country, you have to obey all the laws, and if the government decides to censor an important story, you obey that just like you obey the local traffic laws. That's what she said. And so if that had been the New York Times policy, there would have been no Pentagon Papers. But this kind of docility, lack of questioning, a willingness to basically follow orders from the government seems to apply when it comes to Israel. They're much more brave when it comes, say, to China.
Or Russia.
Yeah.
And so she ratifies and legitimizes the laws of a lawless occupation. And she would have faced absolutely no consequences, as Barton Gellman said on Twitter. Barton Gellman, who's reporting a lot of the Snowden leaks, said he worked in Israel-Palestine and said there's no way they would have thrown out a New York Times correspondent. So these are the kind of people they choose for this job. But let's talk about the reality that they're not reporting on, which you have covered in this book. I think one of the most important chapters in your book that everyone has to read, which has been underexposed in this country, is neoliberal Palestine. And that really speaks to the vision of Fayyadism, the vision that the U.S. has pushed for a Palestinian state, and the vision that they will continue to advance even as they concede that a Palestinian state, an actual viable sovereign Palestinian state, is unattainable. I recently was sent documents that were distributed among Palestinian business leaders produced by McKinsey on behalf of Tony Blair, the reptilian shapeshifter, which highlight what the plan will be after two states. And Tony Blair will be receiving he's called for raising about $4 billion to dump aid into this clique of Palestinian oligarchs who you describe in your book, and let them basically run these Bantustans and keep them on autopilot. One out of four Palestinians in the West Bank are currently living off of Palestinian Authority salaries. So you break down this neoliberal model and you have a revolt, because those are the heads of households. The House of Cards collapses, and the U.S. is doing everything with Tony Blair and the quartet to keep it alive. This document by McKinsey doesn't mention the occupation once, and actually calls for increasing tourism to the Gaza Strip as a economic remedy for Gaza. It doesn't mention the siege or the embargo once. So I want to talk about some of the people you identify in your book. Who are the key Palestinian oligarchs? And I've met them in Ramallah and Nablus. I went to the house of the wealthiest man in Palestine, Munib al-Masri. It's on a hill above Palestine. They call him the Duke of Nablus. He welcomed me in there. And, you know, the first thing he said to me is, "Are you a cousin?" You know, and I felt like if I was a Palestinian, he might not have welcomed me in there so warmly. You know, he has a perfectly preserved Byzantine shrine in his house, which, you know, incredible archaeological finds that no Palestinian from Nablus can access. His home is located directly above the Balata refugee camp and across from an illegal settlement. So you have to wonder how he got authorized to build there. It is an Italian Revival mansion with marble shipped from Palestine into area from Italy. Shipped from Italy. It's incredible, the luxury that he lives in, and he is the head of the Palestinian holding company, private holding company, Padico, which is an investment, which holds the investments of the 16 or so families that control a large chunk of the Palestinian economy. And then you mentioned Bashar al-Masri, who is his nephew, who is the builder of the Rawabi town. I mean, it's sort of modeled after an Israeli settlement. I had a confrontation with Bashar al-Masri in his restaurant Fuego in Ramallah with some Palestinian friends about him taking trees from the Jewish National Fund, which is, you know, the nonprofit paragovernmental organization involved in the Proper Plan, involved in ethnic cleansing. He's working with Israeli contractors, and he just lied to our faces about what he's doing. But you expose, and you've been exposing at EI, what he's been doing, Munib al-Masri's role. And Masri was on stage with John Kerry and Tony Blair to present this plan for an economic peace. So in the time I think we have remaining, I think this really shows where the U.S. wants to take Palestine. Before we get to your vision, where do these characters fit in? And how can they, who are they, and how can this model of Fayyadism, this zombie neoliberal model, be challenged?
Well, it was, you know, sobering and depressing to me to learn about what I learned. And I learned a lot from WikiLeaks cables that we would not have seen without the courage of Chelsea Manning. That's very grateful for the incredible public service that Chelsea Manning did. And what was shocking is that, you know, basically while Gaza was being destroyed, pummeled, besieged, while the Israeli army, with the support of the US, was met counting the calories of people in Gaza, putting Gaza on a diet, to use the notorious term of one of the top Israeli officials. They were pushing these kind of luxury housing projects in the West Bank, which almost no Palestinians can afford, but are enriching these oligarchs. And then you have people like Thomas Friedman going over and claiming that this housing development called Rawabi is the future of Palestine. What they never tell you is that Rawabi is actually built on land taken by the Palestinian Authority by decree from Palestinian villages and farmers. So in other words, you have this Palestinian 1%, which is aligned with the Israeli occupation, which has got totally good relations with the Israeli occupation, preying on Palestinians who don't have the wherewithal to withstand this assault. And that's where, you know, settler colonialism meets gentrification. I mean, the battles that are happening in San Francisco and Chicago and New York over gentrification are happening in Palestine. So, I mean, this is, you know, it was shocking to me, because I suppose what I wanted to warn about in the book is that, you know, Palestinians could end up winning the struggle the way the ANC did in South Africa, and then find that actually they're really losing because the land and the resources and the economy are concentrated in the hands of so few people. So it's, the book is also a call to put economic democracy and economic justice back at the center of the Palestinian struggle, and to put Palestine into the global struggle for economic justice.
Yeah, I mean, you draw a lot on the South African comparison, and I think one of the things that went missing in all of the coverage of Nelson Mandela's death is that one of the reasons he was so celebrated was partly because he accepted this neoliberal vision which was imposed on South Africa. One of the first things the ANC did was allow the water to be privatized. Thabo Mbeki was involved in, before the fall of apartheid, negotiations with the business community to kind of kosher the fall of apartheid with the corporate titans who stood to gain and were losing a lot because of the boycott of South Africa. So, you know, the Palestinian Mandela could also be unfortunately celebrated for accepting a similar arrangement with the Israeli de Klerk. And I think it's really significant that you acknowledge that danger in your book. And you don't present one state as a panacea without economic justice for everyone. And you also include those Israeli Jews who have been abused by the kind of internal discrimination, internal colonialism in Jewish Israeli society. And you present them as the actual bridge builders, the Mizrahim, Ethiopians, even Russians who share class interests with Palestinians. So I think that's significant as well. But we're moving to your chapter on Israeli Jews and the one-state solution. I mean, this is the complete vision. It's a very bold vision, which I've, you know, been until I didn't offer in my book. I offered a critique that very much mirrors what the history you present in Northern Ireland and South Africa of right-wing forces entrenching themselves as their dominance erodes and as international pressure increases. And you present two really interesting quotes. One is by Margaret Thatcher in 1987, shortly before apartheid collapsed. She said, "The African National Congress is a typical terrorist organization. Anyone who thinks it is going to run the government in South Africa is living in cloud cuckoo land." Then you quote Norman Finkelstein, who says, "When I'm going to paraphrase him a little bit.
I'm in trouble.
I had to do this. When you make such predictions, you know, about one state and a regime of equality, you have crossed over not into the promised, but to the la-la land. So why do you think Finkelstein is as wrong as Thatcher is, given all of the forces we've talked about tonight, given the influence of the pro-Israel lobby, given the intransigence of the U.S. government and the role of campaign finance, everything we've talked about, why do you think that we're not in la-la land?
Well, Israel doesn't think we're in la-la land because they're spending tens of millions of dollars and exerting all the efforts I describe in the book to stop discussion of a single democratic state. They think it's a real prospect. For them, it's a nightmare. Equality is a nightmare. But it always is for, you know, it was a nightmare for many whites in the South in the Jim Crow states. It was certainly a nightmare for whites in Chicago in the 1940s and 50s and 60s when black people were coming up from the South to take jobs in the North. And it was a nightmare for white South Africans. And one of the most common objections we hear to the idea of a single state is people say, well, Israeli Jews will never accept it. And so what I wanted to do in that chapter was to go back and look at, in particular, South Africa and also Northern Ireland, and to point out that white South Africans' opposition to a one-person, one-vote system, this month, April 2014, is the 20th anniversary of the first democratic election in South Africa. And so that was 1994. Until the late 80s and early 90s, the vast majority of whites said that they would never accept a one-person, one-vote system. The support for that was in the single digits. And it wasn't just that they were afraid of losing economic power or political power. They really believed, and they had been taught to believe, that giving up power would mean annihilation, it would mean destruction. And Israelis have the same mentality. And settler colonial regimes always have that mentality. Insecurity is bred into them. You quote in your book settlers of the 1950s and saying, you know, we can't dig a well or build a house unless we first build a watchtower and put up barbed wire and machine gun.
That was Moshe Dayan.
Yeah. So, you know, that settler mentality exists to this day. And what I wanted to show is that the settler mentality can be challenged and it can be defeated. And what makes the change possible is when power starts to shift. And when the ruling group sees that their power is draining away, then they're ready to talk for real. And BDS, boycott, divestment, and sanctions, is a nonviolent tool that everyone can participate in to hasten that change in the balance of power and bring about justice sooner. That's the connection I wanted to make in the book.
I think that Zionism has done so much insidious violence to Jews, especially Israeli Jews. In my book, I write about the education system. I spend a lot of time with the women of New Profile, who are some of the bravest people I met in Israel, who are trying to educate Israelis out of this settler colonial mentality, who counsel young Israelis, who are lining up asking them, how do we get out of doing army service? We don't want to abuse people. We don't want to occupy people. It just doesn't feel right. And they have been interrogated. They've had their computers seized. They're under constant surveillance. And I write about a scene in a classroom in a preschool in Holon, which is just south of Tel Aviv, where preschoolers are lined up before a blackboard, and they're presented with a question at the top of the blackboard. Who wants to kill us? And then the lines lead to the historic enemies of the Jews, Egyptians, Arabs, Nazis, Persians, so on. Then it leads to another question. What do we need? And the answer is provided for these four-year-olds and five-year-olds. We need a state. And so from age four until they go on the March of the Living in Auschwitz, where they 25% of Jewish Israeli high schoolers have been brought on this trip to Auschwitz, and they are given a week of indoctrination right before they go into the army. This is depicted in the film Defamation. They're brought into a gas chamber where Jews were slaughtered for a candlelit ceremony, and they are asked to take on the personas of Jews who were slaughtered there, who were killed there. And Yoav Shamir, the Israeli filmmaker, documents this and interviews a young woman who emerges from that gas chamber filled with rage. And he says, "Who do you want to kill?" He asks, "Why are you so angry?" She says, "Because I want to kill Nazis." And he said, "Well, the Nazis are dead." And she said, "But they have heirs." Of course, the heirs, as Benjamin Netanyahu has said over and over and over again in public forums, including before Israeli students, are the Palestinians. So this is the kind of mentality that people are being indoctrinated into, and it is a form of psychological violence. 10,000 Jewish Israelis were imprisoned in 2013 for failure to report to army service. That is a significant percentage of the population of Jewish Israelis who are eligible to do army service. So this vision that you present is, you know, liberating the bodies and lives of Palestinians, but it is also a rescue mission for Jewish Israelis, in my opinion. And it's going to remove them from this system of insidious violence, and it's a rescue mission for Jews everywhere, for those Jewish kids who have confronted us on college campuses with arguments and language that is inhumane, unethical, and obviously and clearly anti-intellectual. And so I think it couldn't be a more important vision that you offer here, but you go even further than that. You talk about what's happening in our own communities. You refer constantly to The New Jim Crow, this book by Michelle Alexander. And you talk about African American males referring to their own communities as the occupation. You know, where I live in Jersey City, there are invisible walls. I live in a heavily African American enclave in Jersey City, but if you go towards Bayonne, it suddenly becomes white, and it's not an accident. It's because there's a regime of stop and frisk that to intimidate African Americans from going there. You talk about Arizona. You talk about the banning of Chicano studies in Arizona. And you talk about similar attacks on indigenous communities in the Southwest. Why do you think Palestine can be connected to any of this? And why should anyone here, especially those people who are the most subjected to this regime of violence in the U.S. and oppression, very racialized oppression, class-based oppression, why should they care about Palestine?
Well, it's, to me, you know, I live in the United States, and I've spent many years working on the question of Palestine, and I feel like we first and foremost have to be part of and aware of the people and communities around us. And it's impossible to ignore that so many of the structural injustices, the violence that is being done to Palestinians with US support, is being done to millions of Americans. And these connections are at the kind of ideological level, in the sense that the American nationalist right wing, and that includes many Democrats as well, talk about Latinos, they talk about African Americans as a population that is a threat that needs to be controlled. I mean, this language has been drummed into us since the 1980s. You talk about the indoctrination of Israelis. Well, in the 1980s, Americans were indoctrinated as part of the so-called war on drugs to see all African American men as a threat. That wasn't, you know, that had to be done to people, you know? And now that this, even this language of the tough neighborhood that comes out of the racial war on drugs in this country, Israel uses it. Barack Obama uses it to say Israel lives in a tough neighborhood. Well, the reason Americans understand that the way they do is because they've already been indoctrinated with this racism at home. So there are those ideological links. When Israelis talk about Palestinians as a demographic threat, this racist language which views the birth of a Palestinian baby as an act of violence against the state of Israel. Well, how is that different than from when racists in this country, talk about the mythical anchor babies that are going to destroy the fabric and identity of the United States? So there's that ideological level, but it's also the ties are real and they're financial and they're corporate. You know, the same companies, I mean, just to give an example, a few weeks ago the Obama administration gave a contract for $145 million to Elbit Systems. This is an Israeli arms company with the blood of thousands of people on its hands. And this contract was for surveillance systems along the U.S.-Mexico border. Well, where does Elbit Systems develop and test those surveillance systems? On Palestinians under occupation, along the apartheid wall that the International Court of Justice has declared illegal. So the Palestinians are the laboratory animals for Israel's so-called homeland security industry, and then those technologies are brought here to control who? Let's be real, it's not white people in the suburbs, and it's not the people moving into the new condominiums in San Francisco and Chicago and New York. So we can't ignore it. Companies like G4S, which is a private prison contractor, one of the biggest in the United States, but it's helping Israel run detention centers like Al Jalameh and Megiddo prison, where Palestinian children are tortured. And so they're making profits there, and they're making profits here. So that's why what's happening tonight at San Diego State, at Riverside, at UC Santa Barbara, at campuses all over this country, is so important. Because it's the university presidents, it's the Dianne Feinsteins and Barbara Boxers and the Barack Obamas who are saying we can never divest. It's students who are the conscience right now. It's students who are standing up to these institutions and saying we want accountability. And the amazing thing is they're connecting it to the prison industry. They're connecting it to mass incarceration. They're connecting it to border militarization. They're connecting it to divestment from fossil fuels. So if we're going to win, it's not going to be fighting separate battles. It's going to be when we connect things. And when we work, the enemy works together, so we have to work together. It's as simple as that.
I wanted to just talk about just a little anecdote from a trip I recently took to Israel-Palestine. And I met a friend named Yossi David, who identifies as an Arab Jew. He was raised ultra-Orthodox, basically left his family and his parents because his yeshiva had grown too extreme. He was told to join the Israeli army to become secular. He turned against the army, and he started to discover his roots in the Middle East and in the Arab world, and he decided, I want to stay here. This is my place. I want to live here without Zionism. And he took me one night to the Mahani Yehuda market in Jerusalem. If you go there in the daytime, you'll see it's a lot of settlers. It's an almost exclusively Jewish scene. It's very crowded. There was almost no one there in this market. And I heard the sounds of Umm Kulthum reverberating through these stone halls, this famous Egyptian tarab singer. And I said, where are you taking me? What's going on here? And he took me to a small cafe called Tahrir. All the staff was Palestinian, Jerusalem Palestinians, and it was filled with Palestinians and Mizrahim, and it was like, you know, what happens after dark when the white people are gone? I mean, these were religious Mizrahi Jews with kippot on, and everybody had pitchers of arak, and they were taking turns at a laptop with a PA system playing their favorite Arab music. Including Sami Maghrebi, the Jewish Moroccan singer and oud player. And this really was a vision of the kind of future that could take place when the separation breaks down. It was a small, very small, tiny scintilla of a vision that is the kind that I think Ali and I want to realize And that's really laid out in Ali's book, and I think that's what we're all here for, and it's what we need to, you know, present and accept, and we should accept nothing less than that.
That was Max Blumenthal and Ali Abu Nima in conversation at the Roxy Theater in San Francisco. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening, and please join us every Sunday morning for news and views from the Palestinian perspective. You are tuned to WZBC 90.3 FM, Newton, Massachusetts. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.